Hello from Midori House in London and a warm welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24. It's Emma Nelson here, and coming up today, in a truly global city like London, what's the welcome like for its refugees? We hear about one play documenting the challenges for people fleeing to the British capital. Also coming up, a marriage of cultures and hearts. The artist El Cid joins me in the studio to talk about the work he uses to decorate the world. And we have a celebration of the termite.
They're completely undistinguished. They're not shiny. They're this kind of a band-aid color, kind of translucent. They have big heads, no eyes, and these little teardrop-shaped bodies.
We discuss these necessary but unrecognized creatures a little later on. Plus, the journalist Marie Bion joins me in the studio to go through the weekend papers, and two-thirds of the way through dry January, we enjoy a gin and tonic without the gin. That's all coming this hour, live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. And to begin, London is seen by many as a truly global city. Almost 3 million of the people who live here were born in another country. And the British capital has a reputation for being a place where you can see every culture on every street corner. But not everybody who came here did so the easy way. And a new play explores the challenges faced by many of London's refugees. Welcome to the UK is its name, and here's a taste.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here tonight. This is the Jungle Fashion Show!
But every little thing is gonna be alright!
That was a taste of Welcome to the UK, and the director of the play, Sophie Bess, joins me in the studio, as does Debbie Karam, an actor in the play. Welcome both to the studio. Debbie, tell me a little bit about what we've just heard there.
Yeah, basically, it's a wonderful journey for me to be privileged to be part of Welcome to the UK as a refugee in the UK. It wasn't an easy thing, but I'm grateful that I'm part of the Welcome to the UK play.
Tell me a little bit about what it's about, Sophie.
So the extract we just heard was about Borderline, our first show, and Welcome to the UK is happening here on the other side of the channel. And it's a satire of the situation for refugees and asylum seekers once they have crossed. So we have men and women and European performers. It's an ensemble of 14 people, and we use satire to address the issues that they face and the difficulty. So we have a panto-villain prime minister who rules a funfair, and so you have many attractions, and the refugees and asylum seekers, and now us European people, because I'm French and I have an Italian and French performer in it. We just try to hold on to the funfair as much as we can. We have massive roller coaster. We have a haunted house where our refugee women friends are trapped in. We have that's a bit of a mad world.
Just tell me a little bit about what you do in this play, Debbie. What's your role?
Yeah, my role is one of a woman that is being trapped, and it's to let the women or the people, British people, be aware that coming here to seek an asylum, it's not all about just coming here to seek an asylum. A lot of women out there, they are come here for a marriage purpose, and being here, they've come and they've been trafficked. So it's an awareness of letting people know that trafficking is not something that is easy for a woman. And my role in there is to actually be the person that has been trafficked and letting my voice to be heard.
You say you're a refugee yourself. You come from Gambia. Is that right? What's your story? How did you end up in London?
Yeah, I came here for marriage purpose. Yeah, and it's trafficked marriage.
And how did you find yourself in that situation?
Well, it was kind of a very horrible one, but I'm grateful that I'm out of it and I'm able to let other people know that there are so many still left there, being trafficked.
And how did you get yourself in a position where you clearly got refugee status and now you're a successful actor on the stage in the heart of London?
Well, I was part of Women for Refugee Women, who helped me through the process with the Home Office. And now I'm grateful because not that I'm out of it, I'm also letting people know that there are so many people still left that are still trafficked and their voice have not yet been heard.
And this play is offering people like you an opportunity to bring that voice to the stage and to the public, you know, to all around the world on this radio station.
Letting the image
Sophie, how does it change the way you approach a play when many of the people who are in the play actually have experienced in real life what you're putting on stage?
Well, that's the aim of my company. Originally, I'm psychotherapist and director-writer. So I have a theatre company called Psyche Delight, and I use theatre as a way to help people express themselves and to give them a platform where they can be heard. So that's really, I've always done that. And for me, it's very powerful. It's very important to use theatre as a way to convey a message, but in an artistic way. I love the idea that they don't go straight on stage with their stories like that, but that they create a whole world where I guess it protects them a bit, but also it really enables to touch the audience with a lot of metaphors, visual images. I work a lot with that because, of course, there's a language barrier for a lot of them. And I want to make sure that it's not just the refugees in the back waving, you know, and that he can really be center stage.
So what proportion of the actors on stage are refugees themselves?
It's half-half.
Right.
It was very important for me to promote integration. So I didn't want to work only with refugees because, with the men I work with who've been fleeing their home, they don't necessarily have a lot of contact here. So I was really hoping that working with UK-based people will help make connections. And it did. Like, they're strong friendships in the group now.
You nodded there at the idea of finding strong friendships and connections, Debbie. What's happened to you?
Yeah, when I first joined, because this group of people mainly are men, I was kind of scared. But now I realize, you know, there is more to that because I was able to make more friends and great. All of them are very, very welcoming, especially to my kids, because I was very, very worried at the beginning. But now, you know, we always look forward to going to Riaz, our meeting with them again and again. So they're kind of like families as well now.
Yeah, because we have a little queen in the group. Debbie came with her 4-month baby. She did the whole creation process. So it's been a year now. And Glory is now over a year. And I was so moved last time because we did a full run of the show for the first time. And Glory was there applauding in the audience. I was like, oh, our little queen, love it. That's brilliant.
She's a proud little girl saying yes. Her mum doing some pretty amazing stuff. We live in really difficult times at the moment. I mean, just in the news now, the first two stories I read were the deaths of 170 people trying to cross the Mediterranean in the last few days. And then my next story was about Donald Trump and his wall. Mm. How much, as a director, how much have you seen the way that we are culturally approaching stuff like seeing other people as foreigners and not necessarily as positive things? How have you seen that change in the last few years?
Well, to be honest, I think for me, they are very, I feel two sides. I feel a lot of people, even now on Facebook, there's a bit of more awareness of what we do. And I receive very nasty comments. But again, some private messages that are very, very supportive. So I think that there's a big wall in between us and refugees, and it's very important. That's why we use humor. We want to try to reassure people. We want to change the negative image. We want to show people's resilience. We want to show that they are nice and fun. They are not poor, miserable people. They are not dangerous. You know, it's for me really activism. It's very necessary because it's dangerous for our society, to be honest, on both sides.
And when people meet you, Debbie, do people see you as an actor first or as a refugee first? Because that can change the way that you then go and behave, doesn't it? Can't it?
To some extent, it depends, because I've seen a couple of people that approached me and they will start asking me, have you been into this for a very long time? And I will be like, not at all. Thanks to Sophie and our leads in Women for Refugee Women, they were kind of the one that strengthened us and kind of let us know that you can do anything, you know. And with that mindset, I'm able to say, oh, yeah, you know.
And how much does London as a city help you to do that kind of, have that kind of attitude, that there are people here from all over the world and we all walk together side by side on the streets every single day? And some people say that London, above all cities, has such a mix to it that you can fit in quite quickly. Have you found that?
On my way there. Not
right.
yet there.
Okay.
Because it's kind of a mixed feelings, and I think it depends on the way I personally, you know, see it. On my head, I'm kind of thinking, yes, I'm there and nothing is going to stop me from being there. It doesn't matter how people see it. So I think it's like personal thing. I see myself being there really anyway, without anything limiting me.
And how much does London help you, Sophie? I mean, obviously you have all these great resources of international characters that you can draw on to put on the stage. So you've got your casting, your casting potential is huge, isn't it?
Yes. We're 40, I mean, actually 60. So someone asked me, but how do you create a show with all these people? And I said, London did it. We did it as well. You know, I think for me, London has a very special buzz. I love this city because it's unique in the diversity, and our group is the same. It ranges from 16 years old to 50. There are some single people, gay people, very religious, bisexual, whatever, like many different jobs, many different nationalities, and that's what makes it unique. And that's what I love about it. And that's what I'm trying to push forward.
And what are you going to do after you finish the play, Debbie? Where does your career take you next? And is it your daughter called Glory?
Yeah.
She has three.
Goodness.
And me too.
Yeah, I've got a handful, and I would like people to know that they shouldn't allow kids to limit them. It was like a struggle at the beginning. I thought I wouldn't be able to do it. But like I said, I'm grateful for the opportunity, because when I newly joined, I thought I would be limited. But because the opportunity was given, I thought then I should balance it. I can, you know, do something with my life rather than being stuck with the kids.
So where's that next job going to be then?
We're going to tour with all our children,
around
Debbie.
Around the world.
Around the world. Thank you very much indeed. Sophie Bess and Debbie Karam, thank you for joining me on Monocle 24. Welcome to the UK is at the Bunker in London from Tuesday the 22nd of January and Saturday the 16th of February 2019. See if you can get a ticket, if you can get past Debbie's daughter. Still to come, we discuss the power of the termite and we try gin and tonic without the gin. Stay tuned.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
Welcome back to Sunday Brunch. If you've only just joined us, it's Emma Nelson here and it's 10:16 here in London. And let's continue a celebration of world culture with a focus on Middle Eastern art now. The Tunisian-French artist El Cid has been building bridges between cultures for years, from the Museum of Modern Art in New York to being used as a teaching aid for young children in the north of England and even a collaboration with Louis Vuitton. Well, El Cid has a new exhibition opening this week and I'm delighted to say he joins me in the studio. Welcome to Monocle 24. Taking a little bit of solace from the freezing cold out there. And Touria El Glaoui is the director of the 154 Contemporary African Art Fair in London. Thank you both for coming in. Elsie, let's begin with you. Your art, for people who haven't seen it, this is radio, so we have a bit of a job here. Just tell us a little bit. It's sort of a mixture of very, very traditional, beautiful calligraphy and graffiti.
Yeah, exactly. It's a mix between Arabic calligraphy and graffiti, but I don't call myself a calligrapher because I don't know any rules of classical Arabic calligraphy. So it's more like a freestyle way of expressing myself.
And how did this mixture come together?
I was born and raised in France, so actually I had this kind of identity crisis. I didn't know how to read and write Arabic, and I didn't know if I was like French or Tunisian, and I felt I needed to make a choice between one of them. And I ran into my Arabic identity and started learning how to read and write, and then I incorporated the Arabic calligraphy to graffiti, which I started before that. And then slowly, actually, the Arabic calligraphy made me accept my French identity. So,
how did that help you do it? Because we've just had two women in the studio, one of whom was a refugee from Gambia. Mm-hmm. And she said that they love London because you can begin to mix with people from all cultures. But the system in France is a little bit more rigid, isn't it? French identity is quite strong.
I mean, you know, I don't think like identity is like it's unique. You know, I think there is, depending on where you are and where you stand, you know, there is one part of your identity that is rising more than the other one. And I don't think I would be able to do what I'm doing today if I was just, you know, like if I was born and raised in Tunisia, because I would never feel like this desire of learning Arabic language, and I would have been kind of conditioned as well in a certain way, knowing how to read and write. So actually this desire of knowing more about the Arabic culture came by the fact that I was born and raised in France. So I think for me it's like I'm totally cool and I accept my two identity and embrace them both.
Turia, Elsie is an example of a growing number of artists now who blend different cultures and different heritages. And you have the contemporary African art fair, but that's just a tiny description of the kind of art that you welcome into your exhibitions, isn't it?
Yes. So basically 154 now is obviously a platform with the mission of giving visibility to artists from the continent and also of the diaspora. What I feel also is that, you know, we always want to talk about, you know, Middle Eastern art or African art, but it's really about artists, you know, coming from a different region or from a different background. So in the case of 154 happening in New York or in London or in Marrakesh now, we have, you know, artists who are belonging maybe in New York from the African American diaspora, you know, who don't honestly feel, you know, more African or more American, but they're just artists with a certain a different background. And the platform of 154 is really about, you know, creating an international platform or platform of exchange between artists, galleries, and the rest of the global art scene.
And how, Elsie, are you still seen as a Middle Eastern artist who was born in France, or are you seen as an artist who happens to have French and Tunisian heritage? There's two different things, aren't they?
I think, you know, like people that, I don't know, I feel like people, they need to put you in a certain box, you know, and because I use Arabic script as my main medium, people define you as a Middle Eastern artist, but actually I'm originally from Tunisia, and Tunisia actually is in Africa, and even the word Africa actually is coming from this little piece of land in north of Tunisia called the Firqiya. So, like, in a certain way, I can even say, like, I'm more African than I am Arab, you know, which is, you know, and that's the thing. I don't want to define myself from a nationality or a space where I'm coming from. I think Arabic script has this universal beauty that I don't think you need to translate. And I've been, you know, I experienced so many experiences around the world, like from South Korea to Brazil. And I saw how people react, you know, like to the script. And I want to add that I write messages, you know, but in Arabic. But I make sure the messages come from the place where I paint them.
Give me an example of that.
For example, we did a piece last year at the border of South and North Korea, the DMZ. And so I used a poem from a Korean poet. I say Korean because the poet was not North or South Korean, because he passed away before the separation. And this poet is called Kim Soo-ol, and he wrote a poem called Unable to Forget. So the poem is a kind of love poem, but was perfectly relevant to this issue of separation between the two countries. And we translated it into Arabic, and I use it on the fence. And people felt so happy, you know, to know that was like something coming from them, you know. And that's the point of it, you know. For me, the same way I managed to build the bridge between my two cultures, I use Arabic calligraphy as a way to build bridges between people and culture as well.
You paint on fences, you paint on walls, you paint on minarets. Mm-hmm. Why do you decide to make your art a totally publicly owned thing?
I think, you know, when you paint in the street compared to when you paint in the studio, it's you live experiences, you meet people, and I think what I love the most about this project is the human experience, you know, because like now I have like friends from all over the world, like I have friends in the favela of Brazil, some friend in South Korea, some friend like in the garbage collector district of Cairo, so... This is a story that I have to say. Like if I tell you, oh, today I was in my studio and I dropped a bit of red paint on my shoes, there's nothing interesting. But if I tell you I was in the garbage collector neighborhood painting on a lift in the fourth floor of a building and then there is a bull that came out to me on the balcony of a building, you say like, this is not true. But that's stories that happen, you know, like I got attacked by a bull while I was painting a wall in Egypt.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
How was the ball?
It's good. Yeah, I'll show you a picture after, you'll see.
I'd love to see it. The thing is, you know, you're painting in these public places, and I think when you did the minaret in Gabès, the imam said, do what you like.
Yeah, exactly.
What was that like?
That was cool, actually. It was such a cool imam, you know, and I'm still in touch with him, you know, and actually I kept the key of the mosque. I never gave him back. But
I think you've just told the world that you've got his key.
It's okay. Now the mosque was built in 1994, and I'm originally from south of Tunisia, from Gabès, and I was looking to paint a wall in my town, and a friend of me told me like there is a mosque, and actually I saw this building for years, and then when we approached the imam in 2012, he's like, yeah, thank God you came, and he didn't ask anything, just okay, go for it, and that was amazing.
So we have on the one side El Cid, who's painting glorious things all over the world in all kinds of places. And then we have 154, which is an incredibly exclusive and a sort of absolute high-end art. And it's amazing to think that, how important is it to create art that is still to be sold at the absolute top level and to be displayed all over the world in a rather elite way, some people might say. It's important to do it in many ways.
Well, you know, the 154 is very unique in that sense, is that it was created because those artists didn't have visibility. So yes, it is sold, you know, to maybe high-end individuals or collectors. But the mission of it, you know, originally was really to give a platform for artists who didn't have visibility. So the truth was really getting them involved, you know, to be part of this, art global narratives that they didn't belong to. So I know there's a bit of exclusivity, but it was also to bring them to the level right away of the other artists from their generation or of contemporary, you know, art industry, but where they were not part of this whole discussions. And I feel like as much as, it is exclusive, we have different program at the fair to make it much more open. So for example, in Marrakesh, there's absolutely no ticket to get into the fair. You know, we are trying to be as open with our educational program. We have, you know, part of the fair happening in universities, you know, open to the public. We kind of like use the whole city in Marrakesh, for example, to be a much more, in a way, democratic kind of, platform. But the truth is art has always been very exclusive. You know, it's not about 154. It's, if you take about, you think about all the collectors, all the museums, all the patrons from the Renaissance, you know, they were not actually people from, you know, people from the people. They were, you know, maybe the richest people in town, you know, supporting some of the artists.
And now you bring your art from outside inside. El Cid, you're now exhibiting at the Lazinc Gallery in London. What's on show there? Why have you decided to come indoors?
I've been painting in studio artwork for the past 10 years, I think. And sometimes it's interesting to change your practice. And I try to, it's an extension of my work outside, you know, because I take back the messages that I write outside onto canvases or sculpture, and that's what I'm showing. But I try to go through a certain topic, you know, and the show is called Tabula Rasa, which this philosophical thought developed by John Locke. And the idea is John Locke said that your brain when you're born is blank, you know, like a blank slate, and you learn everything from experience or perception. And so the idea is to invite the viewer into the show, and with a blank slate, and just gather new perception or new idea of anything that he could have or had, misconception or not, on Arabic script, Arabic culture in general. So that's the idea behind the show.
Well, it is open from the 25th of January at the Les Inc Gallery in London. Alcide, thank you very much indeed. And thanks also to Turia El Glow. You're listening to Monocle 24. It's time now for one of our weekend reads on Monocle 24. This week we hear from a lady called Lisa Marganelli. She's the author of a book called Underbug. It's an obsessive tale of termites and technology. She began by explaining to me where her obsession with the bug came from.
I got invited out on a termite safari by a group of geneticists who were doing work for a U.S. government laboratory called the Joint Genome Institute. They were doing genetic sequences of the microbes in termite guts because termites can eat wood. And the United States government wanted to develop ways to make fuel out of wood and grass and cellulose. And so they were sequencing the guts of termites. So I got invited out on this termite safari where we needed to collect 10,000 termites. And that's where I saw my first termites.
And what was it like the moment you clapped eyes on a termite? Or you'd see more than one, I would assume.
Yeah, they're tiny. They're like the size of like a child's fingernail clipping. I mean, they're tiny little insects. They're completely undistinguished. They're not shiny. They're this kind of a Band-Aid color, kind of translucent. They have big heads, no eyes, and these little teardrop-shaped bodies. They were all clinging to each other because termites are all brothers and sisters in their mound or in their nest, and most of them never mature. They stay sort of a state of arrested development as children because of pheromones that their mother puts out, who's commonly known as a queen. And so just looking at them was to contemplate whether they were together, they were one thing. What is an individual when you look at them? You know, these little guys can't survive by themselves. So what are they? And that kind of introduced me to this concept called the superorganism, which is that many creatures together make up one organism. And then when you look at it in an even wider lens, you know, the many termites together make a single sort of thing that acts as an organism. And then also when you add their microbes to it, you end up with a much bigger sort of constellation of creatures all cooperating to make one individual organism or superorganism.
And this is something that you interweave throughout your book, isn't it? It's a brilliant combination of tiny, tiny details about what happens in a termite's life and how it organises itself and how the communities organise themselves, even from the method of working, like licking balls of earth. And you then have the termite world, and then you very neatly say, well, actually, this is how the modern world of humans works as well in many ways.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And we're also trying to take many ideas from termites and sort of move them into technology. Everything from figuring out the way they swarm to move into swarming drones that we might use or swarming robots. And we are developing robots that can build autonomously the way termites build. And we're essentially looking to the termite for guides for living on Earth and, you know, the next 150 years.
When we're looking at things, I mean, you mentioning earlier on the idea of the US government trying to investigate how to turn termites into fuel. How much are we actually learning from termites, or how much are we actually just profiting from them as beasts and ways of servicing our world?
Well, we all profit from termites as beasts because they basically keep a large part of the world's soil fertile. Termites burrow down into the soil. They change the way the water travels in the soil. They change the amount of nitrogen that's available for plants by producing it with microbes in their guts. They also, you know, they leave behind a lot of feces, and they kind of remodel the earth, especially in dry places in Africa and Australia, in ways that make it fertile and that sort of, you know, support a whole pyramid of life, starting with the termite and going up to spiders and geckos and birds and even elephants and giraffes who are kind of munching the tasty leaves from on the very top of the termite mounds. So we all profit from termites because they're constantly out there keeping this planet going for the rest of us. But then I would say we're in pretty early days for actually putting the termite into our technology. I hung out with these scientists for 8 to 10 years, and I watched them make big discoveries. But of course, we don't have like a big termite breakthrough yet. But that's kind of, technology takes longer to get into our lives and to be discovered and perfected.
The way that you write your book is not just this switching between the life of the termite and the life of society, but you also seem to make what is essentially quite a scientific book, quite a beautiful personal journey as well. And there's a moment where you meet your father and he's being treated for cancer, and it seems to lift you straight out of the book. What was it that made you want to include such intensely personal moments into your book?
I think that when I've covered science in the past, and when we cover science, we tend to assume that we are all sort of imaginary scientists and that we live in a world that's dominated by science. But as I was watching my father inject a drug into his leg, they asked him to inject it in the shape of a clock. And we didn't know why they asked him to do the injections in the shape of a clock. And I realized that while I may spend my life reading science books and thinking that I'm a scientific person, ultimately, I understand all of these things in a much more folktale, primitive story type way. That is, my personal understanding of these things is mixed up with my feelings and ideas about, if we inject the medicine in the shape of a clock, perhaps it will work. You know, why are we injecting the medicine in the shape of a clock? It seemed to me that I couldn't really write a science book that didn't address the fact that ultimately we're not exactly scientific people, we're people.
Ultimately, what will termites do for us in the future then, given the fact that you take such a personal view and tell such personal stories?
Well, I think one of the things that happens when you look at termites for a long time is you realize the limits of the human brain. You know, termites have this cognitive function, a group cognition. They can think amidst themselves. And 50 termites are not the same as two groups of 25 termites. There's things happen and they become more than just the sum of their parts. But as we watch them, it's very difficult for scientists and regular people to understand what termites are doing. And frequently, scientists even find themselves putting ideas onto the termites and then expecting to find that in their experiments. And with one group that I followed, after 2 years, they realized they didn't find what they were looking for. And by building a tracker for the termites, they realized that the termites were actually acting as individuals. So it becomes kind of a meditation on the limits of the human brain, because our brains are formed by evolution, and our brains are also collections of parts that have cognition in between them, but the individual parts are sort of like termites. So I ended up reflecting on who we as humans are and what the limits are of our minds as we look at termites and how they think.
Making bugs beautiful, that was Lisa Marganelli, and Underbug, an obsessive tale of termites and technology, is out now in all good bookshops. To hear more from authors, check out Meet the Writers. Find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next on Sunday Brunch, let's have a look through the papers.
For a global perspective and some fresh ideas direct to your door on business, culture and design, not to mention fashion, travel and much more, subscribe today and join the world of Monocle. As a valued subscriber, you'll get a 10% discount in all Monocle shops and our online store. You'll also be the first to receive exclusive invitations to our events and have full access to the magazine archives. In addition, all one-year subscriptions come with a free limited edition Monocle tote bag. With 4 bespoke subscription packages to choose from, you decide what suits you and your lifestyle best. What are you waiting for? Visit monocle.com and subscribe today.
If It's 10:37 here in London. Still to come on the Sunday Brunch programme with me, Emma Nelson, we'll be enjoying a gin and tonic. And yes, you might think that's a little bit early, but we are in England and the gin and tonic hasn't got any gin in it. So while I let you cogitate about that, let's go through the newspapers now. Marie Billon, a journalist for French media, joins me in the studio to go through the papers for us. Hello, Marie.
Hello.
Now, we have managed to avoid Brexit for most of the programme, but that isn't it's an inevitability that we must touch on it in some way, with an astonishing story in the Sunday Times, May in Meltdown.
Yes, I love the title. It's not, you know, tragic at all to hear, to read something like that on a Sunday morning. But anyway, yes, so it's talking about basically how May is trying to push through her Plan B tomorrow, although by all sides being dwarfed by rebels MPs trying to take control of the House of Commons proceedings so that the Prime Minister would not be able to do anything. So of course that's the tack of the Sunday Times. But I mean, it's quite interesting, the story, because they really explain how tomorrow we are waiting for Theresa May Plan B, and until yesterday we really thought that she was going to show again her deal, saying we can tweak this and that, but that's going to be the deal and there's no other. But apparently what's the Times is saying is that she's trying to get in touch with the Irish to say we can do kind of a bilateral treaty so that there's no need for a backstop in my deal, and then everybody would be happy if there's no backstop in the deal, as long as there's no border. So she tries to do bilateral, but apparently inside the paper, not on the front page of course, the Irish have said no, that's not a goner.
Okay, then, well done, Theresa May, for only now going to other parties to seek their opinion. I found it astonishing that the Shadow Brexit Secretary, Keir Starmer, is in the opposition party. He's a vocal man in terms of being Remain, but at the same time accepting that this is the way that the world is going. Guess how many times he's been contacted by Number 10 during the Brexit formulation?
Is it less than five?
It's less than one.
Yeah, whatever.
And I think that has been the case for so many leading MPs, parliamentarians, political groups who have just sat and watched her say, I can do this, I'm doing this all by myself. And then lo and behold, when she gives it to the parliament, of course they're going to kick it out of the door because they've had no involvement in it.
Yeah, well, there's a constitutional journalist the other day who said to the foreign press, the first rule in the UK for a minority government is not to govern as a majority government. And of course, that's exactly what she did. She governed as a majority government, not listening to the opposition or the other parties. Of course, she's not being helped by Jeremy Corbyn, who's being, a bit difficult in the way that he doesn't want to talk to Theresa May and put some conditions on it. And that's kind of a political move because he knows that if he gets, you know, too close to Theresa May, he might be heavily criticised by some of his party. But in a time of national crisis, there's a lot of people in the Labour Party, former Prime Ministers, but also current MPs, who are saying that somehow the opposition party have to work together when the PM is holding a handout, because otherwise it's going to be very easy to rewrite the history, saying that maybe Theresa May would have been happy to talk to the opposition, but she knew it was never going to happen, so she had no time to lose. So yeah, that's a very interesting turn of event. But at the same time, you know, she's listening and talking to other MPs. Knowing Theresa May, that doesn't mean that it's going to change anything in the way she presents her deal or her vision of Brexit.
No, by all accounts, there have been an awful lot of, yes, I'm coming to listen to you, yes, I want to make this happen, but here are my rules. And and people have just been staggered at the arrogance of this Prime Minister. Then if you just turn to page two, however, well, there's probably a very good reason why she has been able to maintain her position so long. It's because the opposition is totally in disarray. I mentioned a moment ago the Shadow Brexit Secretary Keir Starmer. He is now trying to make the leader of Labour, Jeremy Corbyn, go for a second vote. Corbyn is a Brexiteer. He doesn't believe in a second vote. All he wants is a general election, although no one's entirely sure what that is solving. So while there is huge discord within the Labour Party, within the opposition itself, there's also an article above it saying that 150,000 members of the Labour Party have deserted the party because they no longer believe in it. It's astonishing.
Absolutely. I talked to a lot of people in front of the parliament at the start of last week when they were awaiting the results of the vote, whether they be Brexiteers or Europhiles. There were many of them were saying that what Jeremy Corbyn was doing was very disappointing. And although none of them told me directly that they rescinded the membership, I'm quite surprised by the level of unhappiness with Jeremy Corbyn, because the reason why Jeremy Corbyn was so popular was because he didn't play the politics game. He was his own man. He didn't want to look appealing. He didn't want to, you know, play the games of politics, and that's why he was so popular. But now he's the one doing the more politics, because he knows he's between a rock and a hard place. If he decides to go one way or another, he will lose some support, and he has thought that perhaps the people who the most back him are those who voted for Brexit, perhaps in particular in the north of England, and he doesn't want to lose them because he doesn't want the party, and he himself doesn't want to lose any backing or any popularity. So it's basically turn on himself, and he's now the one who's playing as much with politics as Theresa May, and that's disappointing a lot of people who thought that he wasn't this kind of guy. I see kind of a comparison in that in France, where you elected someone who was someone who didn't play the game of politics, but now is doing a bit the same, or at least is not being very popular because of that.
I think that's the case of most of the presidents that have been elected in France recently. Emmanuel Macron played politics while appealing not to play politics. He was incredible. And then he played politics like everybody else when he got into power.
Well, with not a lot of, dexterity anyway.
Not a lot of dexterity. Well, we're going to head to France in a little while, but it is absolutely astonishing the fact that we are now... I mean, when you're reporting this for French media, Marie, do you just spend a lot of your time shrugging your shoulders in complete bafflement? Because I think that's what we're all doing. Nobody knows what's going to happen.
That's the thing. I mean, in the recent days, since France has triggered its Brexit plan in case of a no deal, my employer have been very interesting into what's happening in the UK. And I said, well, yes, but nothing's happening until Monday. So when something happens, you don't want me to talk about it because it's too complicated. And now there's nothing happening, but you want me to talk about it all the time. So that's the problem. And the other issue, well, there's two issues, I guess, interesting thing when I'm reporting on Brexit. First is the backstop. I have 1 minute for a radio piece to explain what's happening. If I want to mention the backstop, I have to take 15 seconds to explain what the backstop is, because of course in France we don't know what it means.
Good for you for getting it down to 15 seconds. I've heard it done in about a minute.
Well, yeah, I could, but I mean you have to try and explain it as much as you can. That's allowing the fact that you don't have to mention that the Republic is different than Northern Ireland. That's something that sometimes even chief editors are not really exactly completely on the case, and Great Britain and the UK, the difference between those two things is also something that's being missed by many. So, you know, that's allowing the fact that perhaps they know there's you know, two different countries in there. And the other thing is that in France, we listen to what Brussels says, meaning that if Brussels says that's not a gunner, we are not going to talk about that. Although it can, you know, we can make all the front pages in the UK, all the possibilities Theresa May is going to do that. It can go for a week, for 2 weeks, about this possibility of, you know, having some tweaks in the withdrawal agreement, for example. In France, they say, well, that's not going to happen. We are not going to talk about it. So sometimes you're just, you know, nothing to do, although it's raging in the UK. But in France, they say, yeah, no, they're just getting round up for something that's not going to happen. So we're not going to talk about that.
I do wonder what the European media thinks of the fact that the United Kingdom is just running around in this thing. We're going to demand this from Brussels. We're going to demand that from Brussels. And you just know that 27 countries, actors won through Michel Barnier, and that is that. And it is simple. It's astonishing how the European Union indeed has lived up to its name in all this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if there's something, I mean, there's a lot of criticism of the EU that's sparked with the Brexit in particular. But one thing is for sure is that they've been able to keep some kind of solidarity between themselves, have a united voice, which is basically a showcase of how a political union can work in terms of difficulties.
Let's move to a French newspaper, the Journal du Dimanche, which is a big newspaper that comes out every Sunday, yes. Hence its name. It has an interview with the CEO of BFM TV, which is a 24-hour news channel. It's an excellent one. It's comparatively new, sprung up from nowhere, and then suddenly became really good in the go-to television station. His reporters have become the target of violent attacks by the Gilets Jaunes.
Yes, yes, them in particular. BFM TV is seen as, by many of the Gilets Jaunes, as, you know, the Pravda of the Élysée, the press that supports Emmanuel Macron, and they don't trust the journalists over there. And it sprang out to all the journalists in general in France, meaning that there's the real defiance of journalists thinking that we only report what we want to report and not the truth. And even one said one of my colleagues, well, we don't trust you and we don't want to talk to you. But have you heard about RT, this media who tells the truth? So that's the level. RT, of course, is the Russian media. Yeah, Russia Today. And we know for sure that it's not completely, you know, independent. But yes, there's been a lot of hostility against the journalists because first BFM TV has been accused to focus too much on the violence. And it's true that for 24-hour TV, when there's something happening, they do a lot on one thing in particular and they're very much on the image. And when you have tear gas, when you have fire, you know, cars on fire and this kind of thing, they do tend to run these images a lot. And the Gilets Jaunes have decided, or I've seen that, as you want to portray us as, you know, a violent mob and not as citizens wanting to get something. So they went completely on the other side and they asked one of the Gilets Jaunes to be a chroniqueer and to do some kind of editorials on the TV channel. And she's been herself, she's the lady that was selected amongst the Gilets Jaunes to do that on TV. She's been accused and had death threat by other Gilets Jaunes saying that you're practicing with the enemy. So in the end, it didn't happen.
It's astonishing, isn't it? He's put an appeal out, hasn't he, saying don't break the thermometer, yeah. Effectively saying that broadcasters and the media are just there to listen to opinion, and it's not a reason to attack them simply because what you are hearing in the media doesn't necessarily chime with what you think.
Absolutely. And there's a letter of many Gilets Jaunes that was published this weekend saying, we are happy that the media are doing their jobs and we understand that sometimes we don't like what they're saying, but that's the role of the media to do their work however they see fit. But that's just a minority. And a lot of Gilets Jaunes are really thinking that they are trying to put the temperature much more higher than it is for real, and that they're just twisting the facts.
Whereas I know for a fact that when a demonstration takes place in London and I'm reporting on it, we always make sure to just be absolutely sure that we only ever report on it when it is a proper demonstration of a big number. Mm-hmm. Other than that, because you can be really, really easily led into whipping up covering something.
Absolutely.
Because when a camera arrives, people change their behaviour, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. And that's have been absolutely the case for BFM. And because there's this, you know, this importance of the regions in France, and because the squatting of the roundabouts have been happening in the regions, and there was only big demonstrations in Paris and in some other big cities, it was difficult for the press to know what to cover.
We have to leave it there. Mary Billon, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. It started off as a love affair between two science students at university in London, and it's now grown into a successful soft drinks company with 10 employees and huge plans for expansion. Square Root Soda Works has been going since 2012 and is the brainchild of Ed Taylor and Robin Sims, and I'm delighted to say they join me with drinks in the studio at Monocle 24 now. Robin, Ed, thank you so much for coming in. Sorry for sort of summing up your entire professional life there in about 15 seconds, but Robin, this really was the beginning of a love affair at university, wasn't it, that got you two together and got your minds together?
Yeah, definitely. So Ed and I we met while we were at UCL, just down the road from where we are now. We didn't actually get together until after university, and that is 100% Ed's fault.
Yep, sorry.
But yeah, we both basically had a mutual love of creating stuff at home. And that's really what led us to starting to do this.
Which is brilliant, because most partners don't really create a great deal together. But you two, right from the word go, were up for making delicious things in your kitchen. And it all started off with ginger beer. Is that right, Ed?
That's right, yeah. I was working at a Redemption Brewery up in Tottenham at the time. And for a bit of fun at home, we just started making ginger beer. And I think that was the first product that we made that really worked.
So we started off as a market stall in Haringey, and we were selling lots and lots of different things like cakes and sweets. And we also had a keg of ginger beer on the table, and it was really that people kept coming back to buy.
Just tell us a little bit more about the fact that you made ginger beer for fun. Now, lots of couples. I can honestly say, hand on heart, that you're the first couple that I've ever met who said we made ginger beer for fun. How did the ginger beer conversation come about?
I mean, you know, obviously you start by looking at the market and tasting different ginger beers, feeling a little dissatisfied with what's available, and just going, darling, would you like, you know, to brew tonight? And, I don't know, it's a bit weird that we did that, really, looking back.
But you say, Robin, sort of... you had families who'd both done ginger beer when you were kids.
Both our parents had grown up making ginger beer with something that's called a ginger beer plant, which is a particular kind of yeast that apparently used to be readily available in people's kitchens. And yeah, it's just from talking to them about what they used to do when they were kids that we decided that we wanted to give it a go. And we just got on eBay and started searching for a ginger beer plant.
And from then on, Square Root Soda Works arrives, and then you start to sell it at farmers markets. And you're saying that the ginger beer thing then starts to go off, and then what happens?
So then we started looking for the next flavour. We're always playing around with flavours at home, and we'll often go to farmers markets and find an interesting piece of fruit or something, and we'll be like, yeah, this tastes really good. We should try and see what we can make out of it. We just started to think about what the next flavour could be, so it became, from one keg of ginger beer, it became four kegs of four different flavours, and then we just rotate through whatever was interesting us.
What was it like upscaling? When you realise that you've suddenly got something going, Ed, and then you think, actually, now we have to stop. We have to call in quite a lot of favours, because you were both working in the brewery industry, weren't you?
And that,
were you,
that's right.
Were you just jumping from, how were you actually getting this stuff made?
Well, so when we first decided to make the first batch for sale, we spoke to a couple of friends of ours. We spoke to the owner of Five Points Brewing, who was really helpful. It was Ed Mason. The guys down at Pressure Drop Brewery, they helped us a lot as well in the early days. And, you know, they basically just let us have keys to their place and go in at the weekend. We roped in all of our friends. We had quite a fun day. There was about 20 of them came down, and we were just chopping and juicing and bottling tiny little batches of drinks. Walked around the corner and started trying to sell them to people. I think our first customer was E5 Bakehouse, right?
Yeah, the E5 Bakehouse and the Cock Tavern, which is on Mare Street in Hackney, which were both places that we've worked with before.
And the idea is what? You have tiny batches of beautiful, beautiful drinks made directly from fruit. Is that right, Robin?
Yeah, exactly. So everything we do is from fruit to bottle. So we start with a lemon, and then 2 days later we have a bottle of lemonade.
Wow. And that's pretty straightforward, but I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than that, not least actually trying to find your fruit, Ed.
Yeah, so we've been really lucky to meet some amazing farmers. We met them online, actually, and I talked to them by WhatsApp, which I feel is kind of quite a modern way to source a really ancient thing. But yeah, we get lemons direct from Sicily. We've got some amazing growers there. It's blood orange season starting. There's a pallet en route. It arrives tonight, actually, at 2 a.m. if anyone wants to join me.
Now that we're all apparently not drinking for January, I missed that email. You have invented a gin and tonic with no alcohol in it,
which would
make my mother, frankly, want to run at you with a rolling pin. Tell us a little bit about the story of no gin and tonic.
I actually don't drink at all. Sorry, everybody.
More for my mum.
Which kind of led me to realising that in terms of soft drinks, a lot of the adult flavours that I was really craving don't exist. So we started to look at how we could replicate the flavour of a gin and tonic. So I was drinking a lot of just tonic water, but there's something about the botanical flavours that are in gin that really elevates that into a really cool, sophisticated drink. So we just started playing around with different flavours. We have a small steam-powered still, which is how we make the gin extract. So we're doing it with water instead of alcohol. And yeah, it's just playing around with different botanical ingredients and trying to create something that typically tastes like gin, and then mixing it with a really great tonic water.
So what are the botanicals you're bringing in? Juniper, obviously.
Juniper,
what
of
else?
Course. Lots and lots of juniper. We also use Persian dried limes, which are these great black limes. They're really perfumed. Cubeb pepper, which gives it a really unusual spice flavour. We've got cardamom, we've got licorice, we have...
Angelica root.
Angelica root, thank you.
Mm. Coriander seed is important.
Coriander
as well.
Seed, yeah, and a bit of lemon peel to give it a really nice citrusy edge.
Mm. And then you made a gin and tonic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it tastes like gin and tonic.
Do you want to try it?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, they brought in the gin-free gin and tonic. So, go on. Lovely sound. I'm very glad that's not the glass that I accidentally threw around. Here it goes. So,
there you go.
It looks like cloudy lemonade. Could you explain to us a little bit about the design of your beautiful bottles too?
So, up until this point, we've pretty much done it all in-house. We work with a friend of ours who draws the botanicals. We colour them in and arrange them and make the labels that we have here. We've got quite an unusual wraparound that makes part of the logo. It's quite nice.
Where can we find your lovely drinks?
You can find them in all BrewDog bars, the Draft House bars in London.
The gin and tonic specifically, you can get it in Borough Wines, you can buy it in Clapton Craft. We also have our own online store. You can purchase it for home delivery.
And that's all we have time for this edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. Thanks to my guests, Robin Sims and Ed Taylor, who brought in the lovely drinks. And thanks also to our producer and studio manager, George McDonough, our researcher, Mariana Legresta. And coming up, we have Otis on the Midori House Sessions. And then from midday, Tom Edwards and Fernanda Augusta Pacheco bring us the Monocle Weekly. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend, wherever you are, whatever you're up to.